Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayana Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Saraswatim Vyasam. Tato Jaya Mudirayet. Nasta Prayesha Badreshu. Nityam Bhagavata Sivayam. Bhagavati Uttama Shloke. Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. Hare Krishna. So we are reading today from the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, second chapter, text number 11. All right. 103. Varanti tattva vidas. Tattvam yajnanam advayam. Brahmeti paramatmeti. Bhagavaniti shabdate. Vedanti tattva vidas. Tattvam yajnanam advayam. Brahmeti paramatmeti. Bhagavaniti shabdate. Vedanti tattva vidas. Tattvam yajnanam advayam. Brahmeti paramatmeti. Bhagavaniti shabdate. They say tat, that tattva vida, the learned souls, tattvam, the absolute truth, yat, which, jnanam, knowledge, advayam, non-dual, brahma iti, known as Brahman, paramatma iti, known as paramatma, Bhagavan, or Bhagavaniti, known as Bhagavan, Shabdhati, it so sounded. Translation and purport by His Divine Loving Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Purport. The absolute truth is both subject and object. And there is no qualitative difference there. Therefore, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan are qualitatively one and the same. The same substance is realized as impersonal Brahman by the students of the Upanishads, as localized Paramatma by the Hiranyagarbhas or the yogis, and as Bhagavan by the devotees. In other words, Bhagavan, or the personality of Godhead, is the last word of the absolute truth. Paramatma is the partial representation of the personality of Godhead, and impersonal Brahman is the glowing effulgence of the personality of Godhead, as the sun rays are to the sun god. Less intelligent students of either of the above schools sometimes argue in favor of their own respective realization, but those who are perfect seers of the absolute truth know well that the above three features, of the absolute truth are different perspective views seen from different angles of vision. As it is explained in the fifth shloka of the first chapter of the Bhagavatam, the supreme truth is self-sufficient, cognizant, and free from the illusion of relativity. In the relative world, the knower is different from the known, but in the absolute truth, both the knower and the known are one and the same thing. In the relative world, the knower is the living spirit or superior energy, whereas the known is inert matter or inferior energy. Therefore, there is a duality of inferior and superior energy. Whereas in the absolute realm, both the knower and the known are of the same superior energy. There are three kinds of energies of the supreme energetic. There is no difference between the energy and the energetic, but there is a difference of quality of energies. The absolute realm and the living energies are of the same superior energy, but the material world is inferior energy. The living being in contact with the inferior energy is illusioned, thinking he belongs to the inferior energy. Therefore, there is the sense of relativity in the material world. In the absolute, there is no such sense of difference between the knower and the known, and therefore, there is absolute. Om Agyan Timrandasya Gyanam Jinashanaka Chakshidam Tasmai Shri Guru Vidimaham Nukam Karadvachanam Pangam Langayati Vidimat Kripatam Mahamadishi Guru Vidimatam Namam Vishnu Praya Krishna Krishna Abhutsurishma Bhakti Churiswamati Namam Vishnu Praya Krishna Krishna Abhutsurishma Bhakti Vilantuswamati Hare Krishna. So, this is a very nice verse on so many levels. But we'll speak on this verse from two perspectives, from two levels, if we have the time. This is such a powerful shloka with such powerful purport by Srila Prabhupada. But before we even get there, I think it's nice if we review what we've done so far so we can get a little perspective. So we see the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam ends with six questions by the sages at Naimisharanya. And the second canto begins with Suta Goswami offering prayers, or thanking rather, the sages for asking these wonderful questions. Now this very first shloka, the very first shloka of the second chapter, although we didn't spend so much time on it, it's such a revealing shloka in itself. And I find there's two words that I find quite interesting or revealing to me. And the first word is Suta Goswami is referred to as Ramaharshani, the son of Ramaharshan. And Ramaharshan was the direct disciple of Srila Vyasadeva. So in other words, he learned directly the transcendental science from Srila Vyasadeva. Specifically, he was given the task of learning and teaching the Itihasas and the Puranas. But he also was learned in the other Vedangas, the various angas, the various limbs of the Vedas. Now for me it's significant that this word is used before he answers. The reason is that it's trying to convey to the listener that the person who's about to speak comes from a very illustrious lineage. His father was very learned, and his father before him. So therefore, the person who will speak comes from a very learned background. So you should give oral reception to what he's about to say. That's one thing. And then the other word that's used is upakrami. He attempted to reply to the questions of the sages. Now it's also a very powerful word in that it indicates that transcendental science or spiritual science is very deep. Nobody can actually totally comprehend. Nobody can totally master the spiritual science. It's very deep. We can actually only able to share with others our realizations and what we've heard. So for me, these two words are very significant. So anyway, after thanking the sages, he does what is the tradition, the etiquette. He offers his obeisances to his spiritual master, Shukadeva Goswami, from whom he learned the Srimad Bhagavatam. Then after that, he offers his obeisances to Narayan Rishi, the supermost human beings. He offers his obeisances to Mother Saraswati, the goddess of fortune. And then finally, he offers his obeisances to Srila Vyasadeva, the author. Now, having done this, and having offered his obeisances to all these great personalities, now, mind you, the Srimad Bhagavatam begins also in the same way. Srila Vyasadeva did the same thing. The first cant of the Bhagavatam, the first chapter, the very first verse, he offers his obeisances to Sri Krishna. So that's the etiquette. So he begins to answer the questions of the sages, beginning with the first question. What is the ultimate good for humanity at large? And the question, the answer to that, utsa vaipung saparo dharmo, that the ultimate good is that people should take to devotional service, loving devotional service unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's text number 6. Now in text number 7, he answers the second question, which was, my dear Sutta, this is what the sages had asked, my dear Sutta, you are such a learned personality, you are widely read, you know the Itihasas, and you also know the various Puranas. But what do all these scriptures, what do all these literatures recommend? What is the essence of all these literatures? And then he answers by reciting text number 7, which is our, verse of the month. Maybe we could do it together. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Jnanam Chayada Haitukam. So he says that actually the recommendations of the Shastra, the essence of all the literatures, is that you have to take to devotional service. Very similar answer previously he had given. But now, as Nanda Maharaji pointed out in a previous class, is that even at that assembly of great sages in Naimisharanya, you had different types of sages were there. You know, you had jnanis, you had yogis also, they had gathered there. And all of them were also cultivating different, they had different goals in mind also. Some were cultivating knowledge, some were cultivating detachment. So he's also speaking to them and to us at the same time by speaking text number 7. He's telling them, if you take to devotional service, the very same things that you're trying to cultivate, jnana and vairagya will naturally come. So he speaks to them and he also speaks to us. Powerful. Very powerful. So, after doing that, in text number 8, he again re-emphasizes the importance of bhakti. But he does it in a negative way. He says that if you do not take to the loving devotional service of the Lord, all your endeavors will be useless labor. So in other words, take to the devotional service of the Lord in order for your activities to be successful. Same thing. It's the same verse, worded different in a negative way. So now, the question may arise, alright, so all the activities that I perform and they are not directed towards the Supreme are useless labor. Then what should my life be like? What should my desires be like? What should I desire? And the answers to that question is, of course, text number 9 and 10. And yesterday, Prabhu gave a very nice class. on that. All occupational engagements are certainly meant for ultimate liberation. They should never be performed for material gain. Furthermore, according to sages, one who is engaged in the ultimate occupational service should never use material gain to cultivate sense gratification. Life's desires should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation, since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth. Nothing else should be the goal of one's life, of one's works. So this is what our desire should be like. We should only desire a healthy life. Because when you are healthy, you can inquire into the absolute truth. Now another thing is brought up here. The absolute truth. And so what is this absolute truth? The answer to that question is today's verse. The learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So that's the definition of the absolute truth by the sages. Now this verse starts in a very interesting way. It says Vedanti. Vedanti. Which means they say. This is your third person plural. They say. It doesn't say Vedanta. Or the two of them say. It doesn't say Vedanti. He says. But it says they say. And who are these people that say these things? Well, Tattvavidas. These are the knowers of the absolute truth. Or knowers of the truth. And what do they say? They say this non-dual substance is called Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. But a doubt may arise in someone's mind. Alright, so this is what they say. Why should I trust them? And how do they know what they know? How do they know this about the absolute truth? It's a valid question. How do they know that this absolute truth is non-dual? It's all these things that they're describing. This question actually forms the basis, one of the basis for epistemology, one of the four branches of philosophy, and the other three being logic, metaphysics, and ethics. So in epistemology, three questions are asked. What is knowledge? How is knowledge acquired? And how do we know what we know? So these are the questions that are asked in epistemology. So why should we trust them? How do we know? How do they know all these things? Well, from a Vedic point of view, three things are given. The first thing is the pramata, the subject or the knower. And then the second thing that's given is prameya or the object. So the subject wants to gain some understanding about the object. So how does he do that? How does he gain the knowledge of the object or of the knowable? Well, that's called pramana. So there are different ways. There are different ways of acquiring knowledge. There are different ways of knowing. There are different ways of arriving at the truth or a certain understanding. The first way is called pratyaksha, through sense perception. The second one is anuman. And the third one is shabda, through hearing. Now the first one, pratyaksha, is gaining knowledge through sense perception. So just like I can see you now, and I know you're standing there, or at least I think I know you're standing there. Right? But the senses are limited in their ability to give us knowledge. Consider this one example. If you're at the railway track and you stand in the middle and you look at a distance, what do you see? Yeah, converges, right? Or at least it seems to converge. But is that reality? It's not reality. So the senses are only able to give us knowledge to a certain point. After that, they cannot be relied upon. So that's pratyaksha. Definitely has the ability to give us knowledge, but only to a certain degree. And then the second means of knowing is called anuman, logical inference. So if you consider the first example that we gave, if you stand in between the two railway tracks, you look at a distance, they seem to converge. But if you apply your intelligence, you think, wait a minute, these two tracks always run parallel to each other. So there's no way that they can converge. So therefore my senses are actually deluding me. I'm not seeing right. So you draw a conclusion based on observation. That's called Anuman. Now, but also Anuman is flawed on so many levels. It's also flawed. It's able to give us knowledge, but it is at a certain point it crumbles also. Consider this one example. In logic, in its basic form. If A is equals to B and B is equals to C, what's the logical conclusion? A is equals to C. Now, this is a logical formula. Applying this formula will sometimes, most of the times will run into problems if you apply it like that. Right? And how is that? Consider this one example. If cats have four legs, dogs have four legs, what's the logical conclusion? Cats are dogs. But is that reality? Something wrong, right? Something wrong with that logic. Cats are not dogs. So therefore, there's qualifications to make it work. There are qualifications to make this logic work. You know, for instance, the statement has to be sound, it has to be valid, it has to be complete, and it has to be consistent. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So you have to add qualifications to the basic formula, to the basic logical formula in order for it to work. Also consider this. X plus Y is equals to 3. In order to find the value of Y, what do? You have to assume X to be 0. Otherwise, you cannot find the value of X. Right? So there are qualifications. You have to add qualifications in order for it to work. There's a... Can you just note it down? Otherwise, I'll just lose track and I'll... And when I lose track, I really go off the deep end. There's a nice... There was one Princeton professor. This was in the mid to the late 90s. Very, mathematics professor. He wrote this book about how math is perfect. Math is the perfect science. You know, numbers pervade everything. You can break everything down to its ultimate element, you'll find it's numbers there. All these other scientists were praising him. Bravo, bravo, jai to you. All glories to you. You've conquered all the demons, right? And then one nice physics professor from Australia counters the argument, and he destroyed all the arguments, pointing out that even math is as flawed as the other sciences also. Very nice. That shut him up. So, the point is, even logic at its fundamental level is flawed. There are many arguments that can be given on this. But, those are just one of the two examples that I wanted to give. So logic is also flawed. And then there's also another way of acquiring knowledge about the object. And that's called shabda, through hearing. An example that is usually given is just like if you go to an Apple store, right? And then you buy yourself a nice iPhone, right? And you find it in a little box in there. And well, what comes with the box? What comes with the iPhone? Yeah, comes a manual. And the manual gives you directions on how to work the actual iPhone. Right? So that you can get the maximum benefits. So in the same way, the material world is given, along with the material world, you are given manuals, books of knowledge on how to actually live in this world and be happy, and also how to get out of it if you want to get out of it. So there's also manuals on this world. And there's two degrees, there's two categories of this knowledge. One is called Vaidika Shabda, and there's Laukika Shabda. Vaidika Shabda is knowledge, it's like if... It's the manufacturer warranty. The words that are coming directly from the manufacturer. These are words coming directly from Krishna. And then you have the Laukika Shabda. And these are words that are, like for instance, if somebody has bought an iPhone, they use it using the manual, and then they give their reviews. Okay, I've used this phone, and it's a nice phone. I followed the instructions of the manual, and I've got the benefits from this. So if you do that, you'll also get the benefits. And they may also give you some techniques that are not at least explicitly stated in the actual manufacturer on how to, you know, derive maximum benefit from your phone. So in the same way, the sages who have followed the instructions of Vaidika, of the divine, Krishna himself, they have realizations. And because they have realizations, they can share their realizations with us because they have practiced it. So the first one, Anuman, is known as the Aroha Pantha. This is your ascending path. You know, through analysis, you try and draw your own conclusions just based on observation. Then you have the Avaroha Pantha. Avaroha Pantha is the same root, by the way, with avatar, means to cross over or to come down. So that's the knowledge that we are given. So this is why we should trust these sages. Because they know the truth. But also, this word here, vida, vidaha, it says to know, but it also means to experience. So it means they know the truth, but they've also experienced the truth. So what better way to know about something than from somebody who themselves have experienced it? So that's the reason why we should trust the words of these great sages. And what's the first thing that they tell us about the absolute truth? That it is non-dual. It is advayam. It is non-dual. In other words, duality does not exist in the absolute truth. And Srila Prabhupada's, the second paragraph of Srila Prabhupada's purport is dedicated to this particular point. In there, Srila Prabhupada contrasts relative reality and absolute reality. He says, in the absolute reality, a thing is always different. In an absolute reality, nothing stands on its own. Everything stands always in relation to something else. You know, for instance, water, you know, just water, saying water, there's two things involved there. There's the name water, and then there's the substance water. There's already duality there, right? And the name water depends on the substance water for understanding. Otherwise, the name water without the substance water is meaningless. And the substance water also depends on the name water for completeness. So everything in the material world always stands in relation to something else. So Prabhupada says here that, let's see. In the relative world, the knower is different from the known. But in the absolute truth, both the knower and the known are one and the same thing. So in the material world, a thing and its name are different. Using the example of water. The water and the name water and the substance water are two different things. You know, I can sit here and chant water, 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 water. Or as the British say, water, 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 water. But that's not going to quench my thirst, right? It's not going to quench my thirst, because the name water is not the substance water. So immediately there you have duality. And then, you know, for those that are Kishore, Ananta, and Tony, on our daily reading of the Krishna book, and the prayers by the personified Veda, Srila Prabhupada gives another example in this regard. It's similar, but he uses a different thing. Who remembers? Ananta? Mango. And what does he say? You are not going to relish the juicy, fleshy, semi-salt, and easily swallowable taste of the mango. So, Prabhupada is saying here that in the relative world, you know, a thing and its name are different. And he gives the example of the material body here, that in the material world, the soul and the body are different. I'm sitting here, you can't see me. You can't see me. I'm hiding in this body. That's because I'm different from this material body. But in the spiritual world, you can't hide because the body is the soul and the soul is the body. And therefore, that's why Krishna, Kali Kali Nama Rupa Krishna Avatar. When Krishna has come in the form of His holy name, just by chanting Krishna, 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 hey, you are actually directly associating with Krishna. Because Krishna is not different from His name. So Prabhupada here is trying to emphasize here that duality does not exist in absolute. Alright. So that's the first thing that the sages tell us, that this absolute truth is non-dual, it's advaita. Right? And what else do they tell us? This substance is called Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So there are three features. One may ask, wait a minute, I mean, if this absolute truth is non-dual, there's no duality that exists in the absolute truth, then why do you have three features? Gotcha. Why do you have all these three features? Right. Let's stump the Swami question. Or at least that people would think like that. But it's like this. Michael is here? Mike is here. Mike is an engineer. That's also my background. In engineering, there's a special subject called technical drawing. I don't know what you call it here in America. You call it that? Technical drawing? Drafting. Yeah, same thing. So, in drafting or technical drawing, you would take an instrument or, say for instance, a bolt, right? And you would observe the bolt from different angles, from the top, and then you would draw the dimensions of the bolt. You look at it from the side, you draw the dimensions of the bolt. You look at it from the bottom and you draw the dimensions of the bolt. And when you put them on the little board thing, you see that they look different. Right? They look different. The dimensions are different, but it's the same thing. It's the same substance. So in the same way, the absolute truth is one, but based on how you approach it, you perceive it differently. So if you approach the absolute truth through jnana, then the Brahman feature is revealed. If you approach the absolute truth through yoga, then the Paramatma feature is revealed. If you approach the absolute truth through bhakti, then the Bhagavan feature is revealed. Now, Srila Prabhupada, can you hold on to the question? Yeah. Okay, go ahead then. Yeah, you need all these things. We'll explain it as we go along. So, now I kind of lost my train of thought. This is why I don't want to, like, it's okay. So anyway, so if you approach the absolute truth from the bhakti point of view, then the Bhagavan feature is revealed. Bhagavan feature of the Lord is revealed. Now, interesting enough, look here, Srila Prabhupada says here, let's see, I'll try and find that. Yes, he says that the same substance is realized as the impersonal Brahman by the students of the Upanishads, as localized Paramatma by the Hiranyagarbhas or the yogis, and as Bhagavan by the devotees. Now he says here, under the Paramatma, he says, as localized Paramatma by the Hiranyagarbhas or the yogis. There's two things there, or there's two personalities there. Now I'll draw you. I'll draw your attention to a feature of creation that you're probably some of you are aware of, that there are three Purusha avatars. Who knows these three Purusha avatars? Bhakti Shastri. Purusha avatars. There you go. Who's it? Mahavishnu? Those are the three Purusha avatar. Now it's described that the original Shiva, original Vishnu, is Karanarakshaya Vishnu or Mahavishnu, right? And from him, from his navel, of course, Lord Brahma comes, and you know that's another story. But from Karanarakshaya Vishnu, from Mahavishnu come Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, who enters each and every universe and becomes the soul of the universe. And then from Garbhodakshaya Vishnu comes Karanadakshaya Vishnu. Shirodakshay Vishnu, who becomes, who enters the soul of each and every living entity, becomes the soul of each and everyone. So there are two types of yogis. There are those yogis that meditate on the soul of the universe, and there are those yogis that meditate on the super soul in everyone's heart. So therefore, Prabhupada says here, the garba, Hiranya Garbas and the yogis. These are two types of yogis. That's just for your edification. All right. So these are. Let's see what Prabhupada says. So Prabhupada gives the example of the rays of the sun, the sons of the rays, the rays of the sun, to illustrate this point. You know, for example, the all-pervasive feature of the Lord is compared to the sun rays. The localized Paramatma is compared to the sun globe, and the Bhagavan feature of the Lord is compared to the sun god within the sun planet. And also, I can give an example that's a little bit closer to home. You know, I have a hobby, which has actually become a part of me that I've been doing since I was a kid. I like to climb mountains. That's just my thing. Whenever I see a mountain, I just feel like climbing it. I feel this irresistible urge to climb a mountain, you know. As we were driving here, we were walking past, you know, as I was coming to Gainesville, we were driving past some mountains, and I felt like telling the driver, hey, can you stop here for 3 hours? Let's just climb this mountain here. So that's something that I've been doing, and I'm attached to it. You know, even after all these years of practice, when I see a mountain, all sense control, I just flies out the window. I just want to go climb a mountain. So anyway, when you drive towards a mountain, from a distance, it's a little fuzzy, right? You can see there's something there, but you can't really see the shape of the mountain. But as you get closer and closer, the mountain begins to take shape. And then when you get to the mountain, you can actually climb the mountain, and you'll find that there's different, you know, living entities. There's lions, there's tigers, etc., etc., in the mountain. So in the same way, you know, the fuzziness of the mountain would relate to the Brahman feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And when the mountain takes shape, that's the localized Paramatma. And finally, when you actually get into the mountain, you experience all these different people that are staying in the mountain. So Srila Prabhupada uses that analogy here to drive the point home. So that's these are the three levels of the absolute truth as described here by Srila Prabhupada. But also, as I was explaining at the beginning of the presentation, that this verse can also be understood on different levels. And I think one of the levels that one can understand this verse was brought up by Kalakanta Prabhu in the morning. That impersonalism. I remember in Mayapur years ago, I attended this course by Ravindra Swarup Prabhu. It was supposed to be how to defeat impersonalism. So, you know, I was quite excited, you know, just some philosophy. When we get there, you know, it started out nicely. But then it became evident from the questions that the devotees were asking that, you know, Prabhu had to change the direction, because the devotees are much more concerned with, you know, impersonalism in our own hearts. Impersonalism in how we deal with others. So this impersonalism is also pervasive like that. You know, in the beginning of our Krishna consciousness, you know, we have the tendency to think I'm better than everybody else. You know, I'm better. We are much so self-absorbed. Then as we make spiritual progress, we begin to realize also that actually, you know, Krishna is there in each and everyone's heart. And we begin to also realize and acknowledge the strengths of all the devotees. We begin to acknowledge that yes, there are difficulties, but everyone is trying to serve Krishna to the best of their abilities. And then when we gain that realization, which can also be compared to the Paramatma feature, when we gain that realization, we actually begin properly our relationship with Krishna. Actually, our relationship with the devotees is a reflection of our relationship with Krishna. You can't really have bad relationships with the devotees and think that you can have nice relationships with Krishna. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. I remember when we, you know, in my beginning Krishna, of my Krishna consciousness, we were trained pretty hard. You know, you were supposed to be hardcore. Never smile. Don't show any emotions. You know? And we were so driven though by, you know, out there, you know, go out there and preach and, you know, tell them about Krishna, deliver the fools, the mudas, the rascals, the karmis like that, that we forgot about our own devotees. We forgot about our own devotees. You know, charity begins at home. There was one instance that I heard from Badrinarayan Prabhu in San Diego, that one devotee died in a room. Actually, this story came out because when I moved to San Diego, I moved into that same room. So, you know, he brought it up as a matter of interest. He said, one devotee died here. And for 3 days, nobody knew that he was there. For 3 days. Only because, you know, it started smelling. They opened up, he was dead. Everybody was like busy going about their own business. But a devotee had died. So, somebody may be sick in our ashram and you're just concerned with going and preaching and doing this. We have to take care of our own, of the devotees. So that's personalism. That's how we develop the personalism. We deal with the devotees. We serve the devotees. Also share one example from I don't like speaking so much about myself, but I have to use examples from my own lives to drive certain points home. I was in Cape Town distributing books. It's a very nice place. And there were many other people distributing all sorts of literatures, passing out stuff. And then I stopped this one gentleman. You know, and he stopped. And it turns out he was like an astrophysicist. Is that him? All right. he had throat cancer. So he'd come from France for cancer treatment. You know, Cape Town is one of the best cancer treatment hospitals in the world. So he had come there to have his cancer treated. So on that particular day, they'd allowed him. He'd been there for a couple of months, but then they'd allowed him to just go out and get some fresh air. So he stopped, and he said to me, "You know why I'm stopping?" I said, "No. I'm not stopping because you stopped me. I'm only stopping because of all these people here. You're the only one who's smiling, and genuinely smiling also. So I stopped based on that." And then, you know, we started talking a little bit. He took books from me. And then, you know, he called me later that day and he said, "Can we meet again tomorrow, you know, and we can discuss this?" So the next day I went, we met. And, you know, just as an intellectual, you know, he was very challenging, as usual. But I tried to bring it to his level. Because, you know, arguing with him on the basis of philosophy at that point wasn't really relevant, wasn't going to help him. So I used his situation to drive the point home, you know, the Krishna conscious philosophy home, that you are dying, you've got cancer. You know. So start thinking seriously about your life, your situation. So he appreciated that. He bought more books. And then I would go with some devotees regularly to go visit him at the hospital. And then over time, you know, I was traveling Sankirtan and other stuff, we kind of lost track with him. But I'd given him my details. Those are the days before mass emails. You know, the only person who had email was the temple president. Didn't have any emails, so but I gave him the good old days. Well, relatively good old days in my instance. So I lost track contact with him. And then like months later, I got this letter, you know, addressed to me. And it was from his wife. And his wife was asking me to come. He had died. The guy had died. Unfortunately, the cancer wasn't cured. It was too advanced to treat it. He had died. And, you know, she invited me to come because he had left something for me. So I, you know, went to France, attended the ceremony. I was a little skeptical. How should I dress? Should I dress in dhoti or should I wear a suit? You know, and the wife said, "Whatever you feel comfortable with." So I went in my dhotis. So anyway, so cut the story short. You know, I went. I attended the funeral ceremony of this, not this funeral ceremony, but I attended after ceremony, so because the French the French have this, you know, after somebody dies, they have some kind of celebration that they have, And then there's also the reading of the will and all the kind of stuff, and you know, whatever you was left to you was given, or you're told what is left. So he had left anyway. So he had left some, money and some books for me. I took and I gave this the books to the devotees. But the point is that the charity begins at home when we cultivate our Krishna consciousness in relation to the other devotees, and then the nice relationships begin. And then there's really no need for devotees to go looking for happiness outside. And even when people see us, they'll be attracted, not just on the basis of our philosophy, but on the basis of, you know, of us being nice persons, nice devotees. Actually, I'll have to stop here because the time has run short. If anybody has any questions, Olivia.